if you see the crowds gathering, I mean, that's the whole deal, is to make sure you educate and tell people why we're asking you to do that. And we ask you to spread. For the most part, at least at, in the city level, we've seen good compliance and work with us. I mean, there are a few times here or there we've had challenges. We've tried to go in and educate people. But it is, you know, that's the challenge. The good news is, for us at least, we've never really had our hospitals get overrun, and we continue to keep watching that every day. It's one of the things I get. All three hospitals here in Northwest Florida, I get their daily counts. Right now we have, as of yesterday, we had 13 people in the hospital with coronavirus. That's easily within the capacity of what our hospitals can handle. I mean,
you don't want those numbers to go up again. But I mean, just to get back to the enforcement, are you issuing tickets? Are you doing anything to make sure? I mean, obviously, you don't want this to spread and to overwhelm your hospitals. So what, beyond telling people the idea of social distancing is important?
We haven't seen, again, from our standpoint and our police, and again, I don't do Pensacola Beach, but within the city of Pensacola, we have not seen that. I've talked to my police chief about it. We've generally been able to go up and educate people and tell them what to do, and they've willingly complied. We will continue to do that. That'll be the effort that we continue to push here. We'll work with our county commissioners out on the beach, but you know, they have a little bit of a different jurisdiction than we do. We'll continue to do our stuff. We'll let them do their stuff, and we'll try to keep working together, and we'll watch the figures of where we are, the hospitalizations, and keep a pulse on things. If we have to pull stuff back or do other things, that's what we're looking to do.
Well, speaking of other things, could I ask you about these checkpoints that have opened up on Interstate 10? Screening motorists as they're coming into the state out of a concern for people coming in from places where there has been a substantial spread of the virus. How do these screenings work?
Again, they have been working mainly in our area. We had them bring in here the state airports for mainly people coming from the New York area, which high concentration for us. We have only 200 miles away is New Orleans. So from Louisiana, we've had significant concentrations. And for us, we're more worried about drive marketability from there. So we've talked with people from Louisiana. We tell them to quarantine.
You're actually asking them where they're coming from.
Correct. If they're coming from Louisiana, they're given instructions that they're supposed to quarantine. They're asked where they're going to be, give an address to the state, and they're keeping records of those things. So
I guess you're relying on people to tell the truth.
Again, that's part of it, and part of it is trying to then follow up with those kind of things. I mean, obviously, there are ways to pull in from a different area, but if you're coming in on I-10, they're absolutely there to find out who's coming in. If they come in from any of these states that have high concentrations, we typically don't have that many drivers from New York in those places.
Grover Robinson is the mayor of Pensacola, Florida, speaking to us today. Mayor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me on, and y'all stay safe and stay healthy, and thank you for having me on.
You too, Mayor.
President Trump's border wall is coming to Laredo, Texas. The federal government plans to build 69 miles of the massive barrier through the city's historic downtown. But not if opponents in Laredo have anything to do with it. NPR's John Burnett reports that an unusual coalition of activists, landowners, city officials, and business leaders are banding together to try and stop it.
When it became clear that Trump's imposing border barrier would plow through the center of this proud city, Laredo assembled what may be the most diverse coalition of wall haters anywhere on the U.S.-Mexico divide. That's a noisy contingent of folks in black No Border Wall t-shirts who took to the streets. They share the movement with sedate bankers in starched white shirts and gray suits who are just as passionate.
Here we have a beautiful river, a historic river, that is an amenity for our city and our area. It's disheartening. And so it's just, why would you want a wall on the Potomac? Or why would you want a wall on the East River in New York City?
That's Dennis Nixon. I talked to him in his plush offices at the International Bank of Commerce, where he's chairman. Also joining the anti-wall coalition are outraged property owners like Elsa Hull. She lives on a remote 3-acre plot downriver where there are plans for the wall and stadium lights every 150 feet.
And one of the things we like to do out here, I have a telescope. We like to observe the night sky, meteor showers, and the bright lights will wash out our night sky. No more Milky Way, you know. There's so many reasons that this wall is just a horrible idea.
And leading the charge against the border wall is the Laredo City Council. The federal government has sued Laredo to get access to nearly 1,000 acres of city-owned riverfront. The city has refused to allow surveyors on its property, contending that Congress did not specify the wall to be built in Laredo. That issue is pending before a local federal judge. Mayor Pete Saenz embodies the close ties between Laredo and Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, in his double life as a mariachi singer.
Con dinero y sin dinero, yo hago lo que quiero, y mi palabra es la ley.
Laredo was founded 265 years ago as a Spanish colony, and it retains deep cultural and familial relationships with its sister city opposite the Rio Grande.
Our policy, again, has been that basically we're against any physical structure. But as a last resort, I mean, there's always a plan A and a plan B.
Mayor Saenz says plan A is to block construction of the 30-foot rampart. Plan B is, if the wall is coming anyway, don't let it deface downtown. There are discussions ongoing with Customs and Border Protection to build, instead of an ugly levee wall with steel barriers on top, a concrete riverwalk or bulkhead. The structure would stop illegal crossers, hold back seasonal floods, and function as a sort of promenade.
It would be more easy on the eyes. It would be aesthetically pleasing, as I said. In this world, I mean, you got to make choices sometimes, and especially when you're pinned down and they got you beat. So we're doing the best we can with the situation that we confront ourselves with.
The agency confirmed to NPR that it is open to constructing a mile-long bulkhead, but the other 68 miles of steel fencing would continue as planned. An Alabama construction company has been selected to build the first 14 miles at a cost of $20 million a mile. CBP says the Laredo sector is an area of high illegal activity and that the wall is needed to protect people from drug and human smuggling. This is what baffles locals. CBP's own figures show that apprehensions in the Laredo sector have been among the lowest on the southwest border consistently for more than two decades. Moreover, DEA agents say the vast majority of illegal narcotics are smuggled in vehicles across international bridges, not by backpackers through the bush. Carlos Flores is a local lawyer who's part of the anti-wall movement.
Laredo is across of Nuevo Laredo, which is one of the most dangerous cities in northern Mexico. And Laredo is one of the safest cities in America, and we don't have a border wall. So where is the problem?
CBP says construction will not begin here until early 2021. With that in mind, opponents are still working on Plan A, hold off the bulldozers until after the presidential election. Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar is urging his constituents to stonewall the feds.
Do not give them entry. Delay the process. And hopefully November we'll have a new White House, a new president at the White House.
And the new president would presumably halt wall construction. But wait, there's a plan C in case Trump wins. In this scenario, maybe he could be convinced that he no longer has to pander to his base and he could pull the plug on the wall. This is what Dennis Nixon hopes for. He's the bank chairman who's a big Trump supporter.
I want him to change his mind when he spends some time really look at the issue, and maybe we'll take it out of the political arena at that time when he's not running for re-election again. And time changes things. People do learn and people do evolve.
Anything to keep the city of Laredo connected to its storied river. John Burnett, NPR News, Laredo, Texas.
This is NPR News.
19 past 8. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Morning Edition, a U.S. district judge has declared unconstitutional a Florida law requiring felons to pay court fees and fines before they can regain the right to vote. He said the law effectively created a poll tax. More on the ruling later this hour.
For people who spend the winter months in a warm state and the summertime in another cooler one, right about now is when they usually make the switch. And that is putting some communities in a tough, tough spot.
We want everyone to be safe, but at the same time, we know if we don't have this traffic, it's going to be really difficult.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the return of the snowbirds, next time on Marketplace.
Hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on WPR.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College, open for learning with a new set of hybrid online and hands-on associate degree and certificate programs delivered safely for summer and fall. Financial aid available. Browse gtc.edu or chat online, email, or call student services now.
UPR weather forecast, some patchy fog, then mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and thunderstorms today. Highs in the upper 60s for the north and the low 80s for the rest of the state. On Tuesday, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely, and highs from around 70 to the mid-80s. Wednesday, mostly sunny in the north, partly sunny in the rest of the state, with rain and thunderstorms likely in the south and possible in central and northeast Wisconsin. Highs from the mid-70s to low 80s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab. In uncertain times, Schwab remains invested in their clients. By striving to see the world through investors' eyes, Schwab offers personal guidance and perspectives. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which aims to improve the quality of people's lives through grants, supporting child well-being, the environment, medical research, and the performing arts. From the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a story now of another hard time. During the Great Depression, the government put many unemployed people to work, and some worked documenting America. The Works Progress Administration, or WPA, hired thousands of writers, photographers, and artists to capture a sliver of history before it could be dulled by fading memories. Some of their work included audio recordings.
Fish man, 5 cents a pound. Folks, I sell them all over town. Come on down and get around.
The singer there, Clyde Kingfish Smith, was selling seafood in Harlem in 1939. Here to talk about these WPA audio recordings is Dave Isay, the founder of the modern-day oral history project StoryCorps, which was inspired in part by those WPA recordings. David, good to talk with you again.
Hey, Steve.
Besides just putting writers and artists and other people to work, what was the objective of these recordings?
Well, as you said, there were about 6,000 out-of-work writers that the Federal Writers Project put to work. They recorded about 10,000 life histories of everyday people. Almost all of those were written, but a very, very, very small percent were recorded on these massive old hundreds of pounds acetate disc recorders, like Clyde Kingfish Smith, who's making a living as a fishmonger in New York City, doing the best he can to feed his family.
In a Spanish neighborhood, I usually sing something Spanish. And I get in a colored neighborhood, I sing something kind of swingy. I get in a Jewish neighborhood, I sing something like, "Buy me a Biff Duchesne. Buy me a Biff Duchesne. Yes, old fish man again."
It's just a reminder of the value of work. It was this desperate situation, and yet this amazing record of that moment in time came out of it, including, if I'm not mistaken, interviews with some of the last living slaves from slave times decades before.
Yeah, that's right. One of the big Federal Writers projects had to do with recording the last of the surviving slaves. Let's listen to a recording of Fountain Hughes, who was 101 when he was interviewed in Baltimore.
My grandfather belonged to Thomas Jefferson. We were slaves. We belonged to people. They sell us like they sell horses and cows and hogs and all like that.
Were you ever sold?
I was too young to sell.
Oh, I see.
If I thought that I'd ever be a slave again, I'd take a gun and just end it all right away. Because you're nothing but a dog. You're not a thing but a dog.
Every sentence in that passage is devastating, Dave.
Well, that's the power of the human voice. Long before starting StoryCorps, I used to go to the Library of Congress and listen to these things. And, you know, the soul is kind of contained in the human voice. And when you listen to these things, you're just transported back in time.
There must be amazing recordings just of people describing their lives then, in that moment, the 1930s or so.
Yeah, that's right. One of the WPA efforts was to record voices from the Dust Bowl. And we have a recording of a guy named Charlie Spurlock, who was recorded in a California migrant workers camp in 1940.
Oh, so this is a guy who fled the area around Kansas and Oklahoma, ended up in California desperate for work.
They come what we call a red dust storm, which come from the west. And the dust was so thick that you could see nothing at all. Just absolutely couldn't see through it at all. The next morning after the storm was over, the dust was a quarter of an inch thick all over everything in the house.
How long did these recordings go on?
So they went right until World War II started. There were some recordings made the day after Pearl Harbor. Some of the folks at the Library of Congress went out on the streets of Washington, D.C. on December 8, 1941 and talked to people.
Well, I'll tell you, I didn't want us to go to war. But now that we're in there, I hope we go to work on them and really give them something that they'd be sorry for.
How do you feel now that it has begun? How do you feel it's going to go?
Well, I hope we beat the hell out of them.
Well, David, I say, now that we're in this time when unemployment has soared to the highest level since the Great Depression and people are struggling, is there some extra meaning that these recordings take on?
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot. There were these 10,000 recordings done during the Depression. Most people don't talk about the Depression. They talk about their lives. They talk about the people they loved, the people they lost. And that's what we're seeing again as we're recording now during the pandemic. People just want to leave a record of their lives for the future, and that's what happened back then. And that's what we're doing now with StoryCorps Connect.
David, thanks for the perspective.
Thanks, Steve. Great to talk to you. Stay well.
Dave Isay is the founder of StoryCorps, which during the pandemic is, as he said, recording interviews remotely using a service called StoryCorps Connect, which you can find at npr.org.
All right, so to become a doctor in this country, medical students have to go through what is called a matching process to get their residency assignments. Now, any parent would be proud to learn your child has matched to their medical residency program of choice, right? But what if the mother also matched and it was at the same medical school?
This is exactly what happened to doctors Cynthia and Jasmine Kuji. Cynthia, the mom, lives in Alabama. She told us about the day they got the news that they would both be completing their residencies at the same hospital, Louisiana State University School of Medicine.
When I found out, I called her. I was like, oh, my God, I matched. And she was like, you matched, mommy. So then right after that, she got a notification, and she opened it up, and it was like, Mom, we both matched. And I'm like, oh, my God. So she was crying. I was crying.
Jasmine, her 23-year-old daughter, lives two states away in Louisiana, and she says life was not always easy.
My mom she's been through a lot. You know, she started at the age of 22 or 23, you know, with me, and she was a single parent. And, you know, to make ends meet, she would clean people's houses. And, you know, as her daughter, to see my mother, you know, struggle and persevere, you know, has really pushed me to do my best.
Jasmine is pursuing general surgery. Cynthia is focusing on family medicine. Mother and daughter will be living together for a few months during their rotations. Jasmine says she's definitely looking forward to that part.
That will be very nice to have her there as, like, you know, a support system. When I'm tired of being in the hospital, I can go visit her and she can cook dinner for me. You know, just be there and be mom for me, you know?
Mother and daughter Cynthia and Jasmine Kuji, planning and pursuing their futures together, both physicians, both completing their residencies at LSU School of Medicine. This is NPR News.
Later this week, NASA will launch astronauts from American soil for the first time in nearly a decade, but only if the space agency can keep those astronauts healthy.
Our goal is not to take any sort of illness, and some of the ones that we're most worried about are the simple viruses we see here on Earth.
Heading to space in the middle of a pandemic, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's Morning Edition on WPR, and coming up in our newscast, we'll hear how some Wisconsin communities are handling Memorial Day events differently due to the coronavirus pandemic, and a look at the state's first biosecure yellow perch hatchery. Those stories after the latest news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump will be taking part in a wreath-laying ceremony this morning at Arlington National Cemetery. This afternoon, the president will be speaking at the Fort McHenry National Monument in Baltimore as he marks Memorial Day. A growing number of U.S. military veterans are being buried without funeral honors because of the coronavirus. Nick Delacanal with member station WFAE reports from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Since mid-April, more than 4,400 veterans have been buried in the U.S. without funeral ceremonies, including 36 at the National Cemetery in Salisbury, North Carolina. Mark Beaver with the Rowan County Veterans Council says it's a situation no one wanted.
It is kind of heartbreaking to me that they can't have the proper burial, but at the same time, the families are having a memorial service at a later date.
While cemeteries will remain open for individual visitation, public events have been canceled around the country, and the National Cemetery Administration says it will work with families to reschedule ceremonies in the future. For NPR News, I'm Nick Delacanal in Charlotte.
Tokyo is no longer under a coronavirus state of emergency. Japan's prime minister lifted the restrictions today for the capital and four other areas. They were the last in the country to be under that declaration. Japan has recorded fewer than 900 COVID-19 deaths. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Memorial Day is typically marked by parades and gatherings at cemeteries, but some communities are canceling, scaling back, or holding virtual Memorial Day events due to the coronavirus pandemic. Danielle Kading reports.
Ceremonies at the War Memorial Center in Milwaukee were canceled this year due to the COVID-19 crisis. Instead, Center President Dan Buttry says they're sharing a newsletter that features photo submissions from families of their loved ones who died during service.
It's very powerful because you know that it's the family behind the service member as well. It's more than just the soldier or the sailor or the Marine or the airman who goes off to war.
81-year-old Vietnam vet Gail Carlson says he and others aren't planning to gather this year at Greenwood Cemetery in Superior, but they will still remember.
It's going to be different, but it's not going to kill us. We'll get by.
When the crisis ends, Carlson says he and a bunch of guys are planning to visit vets at the cemetery who passed away during the pandemic. Daniel Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Farmery is an indoor agriculture facility in Green Bay. It's also home to the state's first biosecure yellow perch hatchery. The nonprofit recently celebrated a big milestone. Megan Hart has the details.
The Farmery's first commercial-scale hatch of yellow perch fingerlings are now available for sale. The fish will begin heading to new homes in June, but they're not quite ready to eat. Rather, experienced fish farmers or aspiring aquaculturists can purchase and raise them from fingerling to fork. Claire Thompson is the Farmery's executive director. Because of how they're raised, she says customers can be sure the fish are pathogen-free.
So when people buy our perch, they can bring them home and put them in their indoor tanks or their aquaponic systems or put them outside in ponds and have rest assured that they're healthy, clean fish.
Yellow perch are popular for Wisconsin fish fries, but most wild-caught perch is actually imported from Canada. In Wisconsin, yellow perch can only be commercially harvested from Green Bay. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The full U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has reversed a decision by three of its judges last year that said Polk County was not responsible for the repeated sexual assault of two female jail inmates by a guard. The decision preserves a $4 million damage award for the two women. The full court found the jury had sufficient evidence that the county chose to, quote, stand by idly while the women were exposed to risk.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's supports NPR's mission to create a more informed public. From DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to raising the standard of trust online. Used by millions, they work to help people search privately and avoid trackers. DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified. And from the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide to address inequality in all its forms. Learn more at fordfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. 100,000 American lives lost to the coronavirus. That is the stunning death toll that the United States is approaching and will likely surpass over the next few days. The U.S. also leads the world in coronavirus cases, with more than 1.6 million confirmed cases. But the White House is now clamping down on the number two hotspot, Brazil, with a new travel ban. Brazil now has more than 360,000 cases following a surge there in recent weeks. And let's bring in Jason Beaubien, who is NPR's Global Health and Development Correspondent. Hi, Jason.
Hey, good morning, David.
So let's talk about this new travel restriction from the White House. What does it deal with here?
So it applies both to Brazilians and any non-U.S. citizens who've been in Brazil over the last 14 days. So Americans who are still there are allowed to come back. But Brazil is being added to this earlier list of travel bans. It should be remembered, you know, we still have bans in place against China, Iran, nearly 30 European countries. We still have non-essential travel between Canada and Mexico is banned. So there's a lot of talk about reopening the U.S., but there isn't really movement in terms of reopening international travel. In fact, this Brazil ban shows that we're moving in the other direction.
Well, besides Brazil, I mean, where are we looking in terms of hotspots around the world at this point?
So parts of Latin America are really getting hit hard. In addition to Brazil, you've got Peru, Chile, Colombia, and Mexico. They're all seeing surges in cases. Two other places where COVID's really taking off right now are Russia and India. Russia actually has the third highest number of cases behind the U.S. and Brazil. And India is a concern given its huge population, you know, its crowded cities, the potential for a respiratory virus like this to really take off there. So there's a lot of concern in India as well.
I mean, all is relative, of course, but there are places where things are going relatively well, right?
Yeah, that's true. You know, we've sort of got two categories of doing well. You've got places like New Zealand, Hong Kong, Taiwan, where they have brought transmission down to essentially zero, and they are just dealing with imported cases from people who've come from outside their own borders. And then you've got countries like Italy, Spain, France, where they are still dealing with a few hundred cases a day. You know, they've come from having large outbreaks, but the trend line is very much in the right direction. And it's important to note that this isn't just some automatic thing as if the virus just sort of burns out after a certain period of time. If you look at the UK, their outbreak started a little bit behind mainland Europe, but they haven't seen that sharp downward trend on cases. It's sort of plateaued at a few thousand new cases a day, and they're still really struggling.
So, I mean, I know you've been covering this since the pandemic began, basically. I mean, as you do you see a pattern, like as you look at countries that have done well and countries that haven't?
It is really interesting. I think some countries just got lucky, right? The virus didn't show up there until later. They had more warning, more time to get ready, more time to deal with it. But I have been talking to some analysts about this recently, and there are some trends emerging about what type of government seems to be better able to respond to this. If you look at the political leaders in the countries that right now are having the toughest time with this virus, there are some similarities. You've got the Trump administration here in the U.S., Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Boris Johnson in the U.K., Vladimir Putin in Russia. These are all very combative administrations. And on this issue, they were either dismissive or at least indecisive early on in the pandemic. If you look at the places that have done well in containing COVID, New Zealand, Germany, South Korea, they all took the threat of this virus very seriously early on. They had decisive national plans for how to address it, you know, and they managed to get people on board quickly, and that seems to have helped.
That is NPR's Global Health and Development Correspondent Jason Beaubien. Jason, thanks.
You're welcome.
Many of us have canceled or delayed our travel and vacation plans during the pandemic. But it's not just air carriers and cruise lines that are hurting. The destinations themselves are struggling too. From member station KRBD in Ketchikan, Alaska, Eric Stone has the story of a town that bet it all on cruise tourism and is now facing a summer without any tourists.
It's quiet on the docks here in Ketchikan. And in this southeast Alaska town that depends on cruise ships to make ends meet, that's a worrying sight. Patty Mackey is one of a handful of people on the docks this morning. She's the head of the Ketchikan Visitors Bureau, and she says any other May, these docks would be abuzz.
There would be, you know, several thousand people in Ketchikan at the same time getting ready to see the town and spend their money.
It was supposed to be a record year. More than 1.2 million cruise passengers were projected to visit. They would have pumped $190 million into Ketchikan's economy. As Mackey walks along the waterfront, she points out plenty of places for tourists to spend that money.
There's lots of retail shops, souvenirs, jewelry stores, lots of activities. And then we come out on the dock where we would normally have a lot of buses lined up and tour vans.
Across Southeast Alaska, tourists were forecasted to spend nearly $800 million, supporting 8,000 jobs in a region with 70,000 full-time residents. Mackey says tour companies were taking reservations. Seasonal retailers had ordered their summer stocks. And then the world changed.
Overnight, Royal Caribbean and Norwegian joining Disney Cruise Line, Princess, and Viking Cruises in suspending operations.
Voluntary suspensions turned mandatory when the Centers for Disease Control issued a no-sail order. It's set to expire in late July, but it remains unclear whether any of the big ships will visit Alaska this year.
Yep, we'll be tightening our waist belts this summer.
Jared Gross manages Southeast Exposure. It's a kayak and zipline tour company.
Yeah, I'd say almost 100% of our business is from the cruise ship, so we're trying to figure out where we can get new business. Hopefully some local business this summer.
But that won't come close to replacing tourist revenue. He's offering a season-long kayak rental for $200. Tours for cruise ship visitors cost closer to $100 a day. The Visitors Bureau asked 75 local businesses how long they could hang on without tourists in town. Only about a quarter said they could endure until next summer. Cruise ship tourism isn't just the cornerstone of Ketchikan's economy. It also underpins its municipal finances. Sales taxes collected on whale-watching trips, some floatplane excursions, and souvenir t-shirts help pay for its police and fire departments. Over the last few decades, Ketchikan has moved from timber to tourism, and nowhere is that more evident than at Ketchikan's old wood pulp mill.
This really was the economic heart of not only Ketchikan, but really of Southeast.
John Binkley walks to the end of a partially completed cruise ship dock. He's part of a group of investors partnering with Norwegian Cruise Line to turn the shuttered mill into a $50 million cruise ship terminal. Until last year, he was the Alaska cruise industry's representative in chief. His family has been in the tourism business for 70 years, and he's seen it ebb and flow. He says he's confident visitors will return.
I think there's just an innate, I don't know, something within us as humans that we want to travel. We want to go out and experience new things and different things, and I think that will always be there.
But for now, there are a lot of questions as to how Southeast Alaska businesses and towns will make ends meet. For NPR News, I'm Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Alaska.
This is NPR News.
You're tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 8:42. Good morning. Andre Leon Talley, fashion journalist and style arbiter, has helped shape the look of several glossy publications such as Vogue and Vanity Fair. And in 9 minutes, he'll talk about his new memoir, The Chiffon Trenches, and it's about his 50-year career. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. As the complex stories of our times unfold, one thing I'm certain of is that WPR will continue to be your source for essential news, your trusted companion, your connection to the world. Stay informed with us and support the public service you rely on with your gift at wpr.org/donate. Thanks.
Support for WPR's Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship is provided in part by a gift from Frank L. and Mary E. Nicolay. The Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship helps WPR provide in-depth news coverage throughout Wisconsin.
Support comes from Piasecki Funeral Home, thanking everyone for staying safer at home, along with commending our doctors, nurses, EMTs, and other healthcare professionals, as well as the fire department and all law enforcement for their tireless dedication during this time. Piasecki Funeral Home.
You're listening to WPR, and here are some of the stories in the news today. The White House has broadened its travel ban against countries hard hit by the coronavirus by denying admission to foreigners who have been in Brazil in the 2 weeks before they sought entry to the U.S. President Donald Trump has now banned travel from China, Europe, and the United Kingdom and Ireland. Big crowds turned out for the Memorial Day weekend in the U.S. amid warnings from authorities about people disregarding the coronavirus social distancing rules and risking a resurgence of the virus that has killed nearly 100,000 Americans. On the Navajo Nation, which sprawls across the states of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, the number of virus cases rose by 56 on Sunday to 4,689, according to the local health department. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and WPR for you coming up in 15 minutes. And then it's classical music with your host, Stephanie Elkins. We hope you'll stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to helping nonprofits during this crisis by supporting them remotely with their U.S.-based accounting staff. More at yptc.com. And from iDrive, maker of Remote PC, providing remote access to computers anywhere for remote assistance and work from home, and featuring Remote PC Vision, a video support tool. Learn more at remotepc.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Good morning. Hundreds of thousands of felons are one step closer to regaining their right to vote. A federal judge has struck down a Florida law that required felons to settle court fees and fines before they could register to vote. This ruling has far-reaching implications, and it clears the path for many additional Floridians to register in time for November's presidential elections. Danny Rivero of WLRN in Miami joins us now. Danny, thanks for being here. Can you just start at the beginning, really? What led up to this ruling?
Right. So in 2018, Florida voters approved an amendment to the state constitution, and that amendment automatically restored the right to vote for most people with felony convictions who had completed all the terms of their sentence. And last year, on the heels of that, the legislature here in Florida passed a law defining all terms of a sentence as meaning someone needs to pay all the court-imposed fines, fees, and restitution. So that's basically where this started and where it ended up on the judge's desk.
Okay, so activist groups challenged this law. What was their argument?
So they said that the law that was passed by the legislature made income a barrier to vote, and in many cases, the only barrier blocking someone's ability to vote. And they also said that the Florida law that was passed made it impossible for people to get their voting rights restored, largely because the state was, in many cases, just unable to tell someone exactly how much they owed in the first place.
So what are the practical implications of this ruling now?
So this was a class action lawsuit. It presumably goes into effect immediately, and there's estimates of between 400,000 and 800,000 Floridians that are now going to be newly eligible to vote. This is in a state that the last governor's election we had was decided by only 33,000 votes. And, you know, the 2016 presidential race was decided by only about 113,000 votes. So the number of new voters we're potentially going to have here is far greater than that margin.
So any idea how restoring these voting rights could affect the balance of power in Florida?
A disproportionate number of people that have felony convictions in the state of Florida are African American, and African Americans tend to vote with the Democratic Party. But actually, the majority of people that are impacted are white Floridians. And the way that white Floridians vote is much less clear, and it's kind of up in the air as to what that very large group of people will be voting. You know, these are people that haven't been engaged in the voting process in many years. So it's, yeah, it really is kind of up in the air about where these people will swing to.
Might this decision in Florida, could it set a precedent that could be followed in other states?
That is correct. If this goes up and it gets appealed in the appeals court, it would immediately have an impact on Alabama and Georgia, which both border Florida and which both require different kinds of legal fees to be collected before someone regains the right to vote. And there's a lot of talk that this could actually go up to the Supreme Court, and it could affect different states and territories all across the United States.
Danny Rivero of WLRN in Miami. We appreciate it, Danny. Thanks for sharing your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and classical music is on the way shortly after 9, following a news update from NPR and WPR. Stay tuned.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, books, and more. Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911.
For streaming information, go to wpr.org/all-classical.
In weather for today, there's actually already a few severe thunderstorms popping up in the far west of the state. Patchy morning fog, then mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and thunderstorms, and highs in the upper 60s for the north and the low 80s for the rest of the state. On Tuesday, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely, highs from around 70 to the mid 80s. And on Wednesday, mostly sunny in the north, partly sunny in the rest of the state with rain and thunderstorms likely in the south and possible in central and northeast Wisconsin. Highs Wednesday from the mid-70s to low 80s.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. Andre Leon Talley, fashion journalist and style arbiter, has helped shape the look of several glossy publications like Vogue and Vanity Fair for decades. The Chiffon Trenches is Talley's new memoir about his 50-year career. He spoke with NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates about faith, fashion, and race.
A certain echelon of the media world anxiously awaited Andre Leon Talley's book. Leaked early passages of the Chiffon Trenches described rifts with Vogue editor Anna Wintour and the late designer Karl Lagerfeld. But if people are looking for venom, Talley says, look elsewhere.
This is not a salacious tell-all. It's not a dishy, gossipy, bitchy book. It was not meant to be that. It is who I am, it is what I feel, and what I think.
And what he thinks is a majestically sized African-American who's often the only black man in very elite environments is informed by his beginnings in segregated Durham, North Carolina. Talley's parents worked in Washington, D.C., and he lived with his grandmother, Mrs. Binnie Francis Davis. From his grandmother, Talley learned good manners, to make a tight bed, and how to make their home's wood floors gleam with polish. These became valued life lessons.
And these things stay with you. Maintenance stays with you. Polish stays with you.
Style was on display every Sunday when Talley and his grandmother would meet other family members at church.
I saw style in church. I saw style in my grandmother's sisters. They were all beautifully dressed. Church was the nucleus of our lives. Church going was pivotal to our existence.
His happy childhood wasn't totally idyllic, though. For several years, Talley was abused by at least one neighborhood man. He remained stoic and silent.
I did not want to tell my grandmother because I knew whatever it was very dark, it was wrong, but that I would be blamed for it and the other person, the perpetrators, would not.
He soldiered on, majoring in French at North Carolina Central University, then won a scholarship to graduate school at Brown. After Brown, he went to New York, where a classmate's father sent a letter of introduction to Diana Vreeland, the legendary fashion editor who'd gone on to curate exhibits at the Metropolitan Museum's Costume Institute.
Style is everything, George. It helps you get up in the morning. It helps you get down the stairs. It's a way of life. Without it, you're nobody.
That was Vreeland talking to writer George Plimpton in the documentary The Eye Has to Travel. Talley says Vreeland's rigor and insistence on standards reminded him of his grandmother.
They were from different backgrounds, but they were so much alike to me, and I was so lucky to have both of them in my life.
Later, Vreeland introduced Talley to Andy Warhol, and he went to work for Interview magazine. Then on to W and Women's Wear Daily, where he became their Paris correspondent. This 6'6" brown kid in bespoke suits, comfortably fluent in French, was an industry unicorn, and not everyone approved.
I was smart, and I showed it. It goes back to when people can't figure out who you are and afraid of you. And as you boldly, with confidence, show who you are to the world, certain people just have the fear of seeing someone tall and black suddenly come on the surface.
There were whispered racial slurs from some. One white publicist sneered he was Queen Kong. A black New Yorker writer thought Talley tolerated racial insults because he wanted to remain close to fashion's powerful whites.
The person took it out of context to make his thesis for that article seem as if I was an Uncle Tom.
Here are Anna Wintour and Talley in the 2018 documentary, The Gospel According to Andre.
I think that Andre had some ambivalence about talking about race.
You don't make a loud noise, you don't scream, you don't get up and say, look, hey, I'm loud, I'm black and I'm proud, you just do it. And then it's recognized and somehow it impacts the culture.
And it did. Those red carpet greetings at the Met Galas, here with Rihanna in 2015.
Queen of the night, break it up, it's not enough, it's not enough. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Writing the profile of Michelle Obama in 2009 for the cover of Vogue's Power issue. Getting Jennifer Hudson placed on the cover as she was starring in Dreamgirls. Writing about the significance of Beyoncé's choice of Tyler Mitchell, the first black photographer to shoot a Vogue cover in its 125-year history. Andre Leon Talley's artful advocacy helped these things happen in his half century in the fashion industry. It wasn't always easy, but as he concludes in the audio version of his book,
I think it is a true wonder that I have come this far.
And, he says, he was able to do that with faith, love, and prayer. And a whole lot of style. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
Memorial Day conjures strong memories for Dave Shankman. He owns a kite shop on California's Huntington Beach.
We're on the pier and the ocean breeze is blowing right off the water, so we're smelling the fresh ocean breezes. If it's blowing just right, we'll get the nice smell of the burgers being cooked up at Ruby's down at the end.
But not this year, not during a pandemic. The pier is closed. So Shankman is spending the holiday at home, doing yard work.
Yeah, and things are also very different today in coastal Provincetown, Massachusetts.
We're known for being crowded. So how do we reimagine this model?
Patrick heads the Provincetown Chamber of Commerce. Memorial Day usually draws whale watchers, also art lovers, and a really popular nightlife.
That certainly is one of the things that's difficult to replicate with social distancing, the kind of club scene that you would normally see.
In Florida, Miles Howard reminisces about happier holidays managing a bar in Jacksonville's San Marco Square.
Neighbors running into neighbors, you know, their kids playing on the sidewalk, the wafts of, like, you know, fresh pizza that's come straight out of an oven, things that you really associate with Americana.
Howard says even through hurricanes, the neighborhood never lost its unity. But it's just not the same this year with social distancing.
You know, restaurants and bars are all about community and hospitality and welcoming people into your doors. And, you know, that's the one thing that I think we can all look forward to, getting that sense of community back.
Just a bit south of Jacksonville in St. Augustine, Florida, Janetta Salyer and her band would normally be booked solid for gigs today. This year, they are playing to half the crowd.
It's discouraging in the sense of the work that we do is really in building the energy, interacting with the crowd. You know, a good performer isn't just playing technically good music.
She will be back next year, hopefully playing to a larger and less distant audience. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Rachel Martin.
It's the feeling of a moonlit night. The thrill tastes right. Standing in the ring of a bullfight. Find me underneath the maraschino light.
You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. To follow news developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org and join us this afternoon for BBC News Hour beginning at 3, followed by All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30. It's a minute before 9.
Support for WPR comes from UW-Madison Professional Degrees and Certificates, offering more than 80 graduate-level programs, including online and evening options. go.wisc.edu/pro. Your future, your way.
A special notice from WGTD. The Racine Art Museum now has downloadable activity sheets for kids. Let them experience and engage with art from home. Visit ramart.org for more information.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.